You're listening to a Mint podcast brought to you by HD Smartcast.
Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of the Why Not Mint Money podcast. Today I have invited Vivek Kaul, author of Bad Money, who will share 5 money lessons he learned by reading Morgan Housel. Morgan Housel is the author of the best-selling book The Psychology of Money.
Welcome to Why Not Mint Money, a personal finance podcast where we help you understand basic money concepts and share strategies for you to build your wealth. So let's get started with your money journey.
Hi Vivek, thanks for coming to this.
My pleasure.
You need no introduction and the person we're going to talk about also needs no introduction. But for the sake of it, when did you first discover Morgan Housel and why do you, you know, like him so much?
So, I think this was 2020 when his book, The Psychology of Money, came out. And I don't know how I ended up reading the book, but I did. And I quite liked the fact that someone had written a book on money without essentially getting into, terms like stock market and SIP. And, normally what happens is when anyone writes a book on personal finance, it tends to get a little too technical without essentially talking about the broader philosophy of personal finance, the broader philosophy behind savings. So savings, more than being a financial thing, are essentially, or investing or personal finance or whatever you might want to call it, they're more a psychological thing. And it's the psychological side which interests me, but does not get talked about enough. So which is why I ended up, reading The Psychology of Money, because, I mean, I had no idea who the guy was. But the title I sort of found quite fascinating. And then his second book came out, same as ever, which was not a book on money, but that also had quite a few money lessons. So that's how I essentially discovered the guy.
For our listeners who may not know, Vivek writes, works as a freelance journalist and writes for a host of publications, including Mint.
Right.
And Morgan Housel also works in a very similar way. He writes one article per week. And Vivek, what I find very special is that, my boss, who is Neil Borate, he once mentioned to me that Vivek Kaul is like the Morgan Housel of India. And I'll tell you exactly the reason for it.
Okay.
You both are journalists in some way, but not the typical journalist. So I'll explain what this means. So typical journalists, we go to fund managers, we talk to them, and we hope to get some insight from them, insights, information, or so forth. But you and Morgan Housel work very different, right? So you guys read the whole day, take long walks, think about it, and somehow, combine very simple topic, like how Morgan Housel uses biology lesson, history lesson, same way you use movie or anecdote of cricket to sort of write about personal finance. So what's your thought behind it?
I think the thought is that essentially people, when you talk to people or when you expect people to read you, whatever you are putting out has to be interesting. Because there is, the days when someone would just sit and read a newspaper or someone would just sit and read a magazine are gone now, okay? So you are essentially competing because everything is on the phone. So you are not just competing with other people who are writing on similar topics. You are also competing with Netflix, right? So you're also competing with cricket. You're also competing with Insta Reels. So taking that scenario into account, you essentially have to put out content as, people don't call it writing anymore, they call it content. So you have to put out content which is interesting. And how do you make it interesting? You make it interesting by talking to people in a language which they understand, through stories that they know about, through examples which are relevant at a given point of time. Like, to give you, we are talking, today the fifth test match between India and England is happening, has started in Dharamshala. And it's Ravi Chandran Ashwin's 100th test, and it is also Johnny Bairstow's 100th test. So if I were to sort of write something on personal finance today, I would try essentially getting, either Ashwin's story or Bairstow's story or some data point from their careers into the piece. So that would automatically, you know, I mean, so the other thing it does is that the moment you put Ashwin and money in the headline, people are interested, you know, what is this about? So that is the basic idea. It is to essentially talk to people in a language using examples that they relate to.
Vivek, I'm really sorry for disturbing you during your cricket, you know, match. But for context, the cricket match is happening right now.
Right.
Yes. I was watching cricket the other day and I think I also got, you know, a fantastic finance lesson. So I was watching, I think, Australia and Pakistan under 19 World Cup.
Right.
And the commentator casually was just saying there is only a 27% chance, I forgot the exact number, but of them getting selected in the national team, which...
It was 27%. Basically, you know, once you have played the under 19 for your country, the chances that you will make it to the senior cricket team are 27%. So basically, one in four individuals, if we were to round it off, who play under 19 cricket, end up playing for their nation as well. And this percentage varies across different countries. So, I mean, I have followed cricket for a while now, and I know so many under 19 cricket players who did not really make it. In fact, some did not even do well at the Ranji Trophy level, even though they were, they did represent their country in the under 19 level. So.
I think we have diverged too much to cricket, but any money lessons you can think from this, you know, from this fact that very few people make it to the national team, even if they are in the...
Of course. So the money lesson here is that... you know, you might end up, you know, what these fund managers call a multi-bagger. So a lot of multi-baggers at the end of the day are obvious in hindsight. So your chances of essentially investing in a multi-bagger and riding it are very, very low to start with. And by your, I'm sure there are many people out there who have done it. But I'm talking about, you know, at an aggregate level, the probability is very, very low, which is why it essentially for a normal guy who has a day job and who has family responsibilities and who has other interests in life, it essentially makes more sense to just invest in equity mutual funds through the SIP route and not try to sort of, you know, take a punt on, you know, this stock will double or triple or so. That does not normally. So it's probability basically. So that's one lesson we can draw.
Interesting. And that was quick. And so, yeah, let's jump right into the main topic, which is, you know, money lessons from Morgan Housel. Vivek has 10 money lessons, but for this episode, we'll take up 5 of them.
Sure.
And people don't need to know Morgan Housel or don't need to know anything about investment to understand these 5 points. So here we begin. So what do you mean when you say the Warren Buffett principle?
Okay, so this is something that Housel talks about. See, again, you know, he could have simply said the power of compounding, which, you know, every second or third personal finance article talks about. But then, you know, if you say power of compounding, you're like, you know, who's going to read? Yeah. So what the story that he uses to essentially bring forward the point about the power of compounding is that of Warren Buffett. And so I think this is there in his first book, Psychology of Money, wherein he says that Warren Buffett made a bulk of his money post turning 50. Okay. So I think the numbers he uses is that, and this is 2020. So probably this would probably be 2019 numbers or whatever. I mean, that's not important. What is important is the principle behind the story. So Warren Buffett at that point of time was worth around 84.5 billion or some such large number. And 84.2 billion of that was made after he turned 50. Okay. So this is the power of compounding. Now, what does it mean in very simple terms? It essentially means that, let's say you have 1 lakh rupees, okay, and you invest that in a fixed deposit, a simple fixed deposit, total no-brainer. That at this point of time would probably give you a return of 7.5% per year, 7%. So that's 7,000 rupees. But let's say you have 10 lakh rupees. So 10 lakh, immediately the 7% on that would be 70,000. So what happens? So essentially what happens is that as your corpus grows over the years, and reaches a certain size in a certain number of years, the power, then the real power of compounding starts coming in, because your money starts growing by huge amounts in absolute terms. So as I said, at 1 lakh, it will be 7,000 rupees, but at 10 lakhs, it will be 70,000 rupees. At 1 crore, it will be 7 lakh rupees. Okay. So which is why, you know, the broader lesson here is that, which is why the rich, once you become rich, you continue to be rich, unless you sort of, you know, throw away your money in useless things. So again, you know, to sort of relate it to an Indian context, an excellent way to follow this principle in India is to invest in the public provident fund. I mean, right now you do 1,50,000 rupees every year, and it gives you 7.1% interest every year, and your the amount at maturity is tax free. So it effectively means around 10% return guaranteed by the government of India. So it's a total no-brainer. But still a lot of people don't do it. So you will end up, I mean, I don't remember the exact numbers, but so you can keep extending, you know, it's I think for initially for a period of 15 to 16 years, and then you can keep extending it by a period of 5 years. At the end of 30 years, you can end up with some 1.6, 1.7 crore, which is for a totally automated investing strategy where you do not have to use your brains at all, a pretty good amount of money. So which is what, you know, the Warren Buffett principle is basically about. So you don't have to necessarily, what I'm trying to say is, invest in stocks. You can even, you know, earn slightly lower returns, but of course, you know, in a way guaranteed returns, and follow the Warren Buffett principle.
So in other way to keep it is, you know, instead of focusing too much on earning extra return, you can focus on maximizing.
Exactly. Basically, it's not a 100 meter sprint. Investing is not a 100 meter sprint. It is a 42 kilometer marathon. And you have to, you know, and a marathon cannot be run at the speed of a 100 meter sprint. So you have to pace yourself.
Vivek, do you remember the first story in the Psychology of Money book? I think it's about this guy who is a janitor, a philanthropist, and a millionaire.
Oh yes, something. Of course. So there was this guy who kept buying stocks, and I don't remember his name, but when he
Ronald Reed or something.
Okay. When he died, his portfolio was worth millions of dollars. So he just kept buying and holding on to what he had. So that is the, I mean, you know, it's easy to talk about this, but it is very difficult to continue holding on to what you have invested in.
Just imagine you having $1 million and not having a car or something. Yeah.
I mean, I can imagine that for myself. I'm not interested in cars.
You might be the next, Ronald. So, coming to the second money lesson, it's you titled it the Do Nothing Principle.
Yeah.
So what does it mean? You do nothing.
I mean, so basically, so let's talk about fund managers, okay? So fund managers in India have this, at least they used to until a few years back, they would tell you that Sensex has given you a return of 18% per year since 1979, or 19%. I mean, depending on their mood, they would use any figure from 17 to 19% would be used. And obviously, they were not wrong about it. They're right. But, you know, what they did not tell us was that a bulk of these returns were earned up until 1992, when most of us weren't around investing in the stock market, right? If you look at Sensex returns from 1992 onwards, and I mean, I haven't checked the number in a year and a half, but from 1992 over a three-decade period, the Sensex returns were around 9% per year, okay? So you add dividend yield of 1.5%, so it's 10.5%. So obviously, in 1992, the markets were at a peak. So I'm talking from a peak level, right? So which is also not correct. So the number I like to look at is, you have the Nifty Total Return Index data, which essentially takes the dividends of stocks which constitute the Nifty 50 index into account as well. So from that data is available from 1999, June 30th, 1999. So the returns on that are around 13% per year, okay? So 13% per year is a fantastic number. You know, your money doubles in 5 to 6 years, five and a half years. So the do nothing principle essentially is to just invest in these Nifty 50 stocks. Basically, invest in an index fund or an exchange traded fund and do it regularly month in, month out, or whenever you have some amount of money coming in. And just, you know, it's like, I mean, you're too young to remember this. There used to be this old Hero Honda ad, which would, you know, go fill it, shut it, forget it. So okay. This is exactly like that. That's the do nothing principle. Because what will happen is, but then, you know, it's very difficult because there is so much noise around the entire investing thing. So there is noise on TV, there is noise on, you know, in newspapers, there is noise in digital medium, now there is noise through financial influencers. So it is very difficult to remain sane when the entire world around you is going mad, or at least seems to be going mad. So that's the do-nothing principle at its, you know, at its very core.
So Vivek, this sounds very, you know, simple, but from my experience, what I've seen is either people are hyperactive on investments and trading, which basically means they are doing F&O, intraday, whatnot. And on the other extreme, there are people who, you know, completely ignore investing. You know, there are many people in between who, you know.
So which is why what I said. So see, good investing should be very boring. The moment you are getting a thrill out of it, there is something not right about it. So to sort of, if I were to explain it to you in the context of being in Mumbai, where, you know, both of us are. So if you let's say go to one of these investing conferences, which, you know, the season for which is currently on. So people will meet there and, you know, while they have their coffee probably in the sun and they'll ask you, kya lagta hai? So what is it that you think? So I find people who talk about investing to be extremely boring people because their lives are very, very limited because they get excited by this just one particular thing, stock market, where it is going, stock market, where will it go? But ultimately, see, genuine money is made. So to sort of take the thought forward, you know, you can become wealthy quickly in three ways. One is if you inherit money, right? I mean, two is if you steal it. And the third is if you're lucky enough to be running a startup where a VC essentially invests a lot of money at a, you know, very huge valuation, right? And I mean, there are always exceptions to any rule. But as I said, to become wealthy through investing is a process which takes time. Now, obviously, there are, you know, people who essentially get around this, you know, guys like Rakesh Jhunjhunwala, but they are the exceptions which prove the rule that it takes time to get wealthy through investing, which is why Warren Buffett also says, you know, that people should stick to investing in index funds. So I mean, if you find index funds extremely boring, then at least stick to investing in diversified equity mutual funds. So you can do a large cap fund, a mid cap fund, and a small cap fund, and a gold ETF, and you're done. And you can look at it a couple every 2 years and see. Also, you know, I find in mutual funds, people chase short-term performance, which is a very stupid thing to do because short-term performance keeps changing. You know, if you look at, and I haven't done this in many years, but, you know, when I used to look at mutual fund data very carefully, the one-year top performers would keep changing. But if you looked at, you know, funds which did well over a period of 5 years, that would be a more stable sample. So you have to look at funds which are just, you know, so if you were to sort of divide these funds into four quartiles, you have to look at funds which are either in the second quartile or even in the top of the third quartile. So because over a period of, you know, 15 years or 10 years, a lot of these funds which might come out on top may not be the ones which would be topping the charts in 1 year rankings.
But this is exactly what people do, right? Because the apps are also designed
because
that way.
Because it's exciting, right? Apps, what is, you know, app is essentially, you know, why, I mean, to be, you know, even though a lot of these apps are very user friendly, at the end of the day, why do you need an app to invest in a mutual fund? I mean, I don't get it. You don't need an app. You can just, you know, you can even have a mutual fund agent and just go through. I mean, obviously, then that agent and you need to be on your on the same level because agents also have their agendas. So, and I mean, I say this, I mean, I have an app, but I have control over, I mean, I don't like, you know, essentially change my SIPs every day or I don't do stuff like that. So, ideally, you don't even need an app. Why do you have to sit in a local train and look at, you know, how does that help? So investing decisions should not be made, you know, when you're looking at an app in a local train or in a cab or, you know, in a metro somewhere. It's not done. So.
So moving on to the next money lesson, you have titled it, How Not to Take Cues from Others.
Huh, and so this is again, you know, because there is so much noise related to investing at, you know, around us at any point of time. So it is, again, you know, I mean, so basically it goes back to, you know, investing in the broader index and sticking to that. But the moment if you sort of try getting influenced by the world around you, you will end up doing things which are popular at that point of time, which might work. I mean, you know, if you had, you know, if people who have bet their lives on small cap stocks in the last few years have done extremely well for themselves. But the point again is that, you know, when you start betting on something, you don't know whether that bet will continue to be right in the future as well. So which is why, you know, diversification is, I think, the most important investing principle. And, you know, as we were discussing before we started recording this, in the last few years, anyone who has said this has looked very stupid because it's concentrated portfolios which have done well. But then to sort of give you a few examples, you know, you look at small cap stocks, the BSE small cap index, which has, I mean, I think more than 900 stocks, essentially reached a high, its then high in early 2008. It only crossed that high again in March 2017, 9 years. The same with the BSE PSU index, the high that it reached in 2008 was crossed only in 2023. So once you start taking these factors into account, you essentially, you know, I mean, you should generally be avoiding noise. Now, if you don't want to avoid noise, and, you know, it might just make some sense to have a small part of your portfolio playing on the noise as well. But you can't bet your life on it. So to give
you have a portfolio where you, you know, place these small bets according to, you know,
I'm not good at it. Yeah. I have tried. But, you know, typically by the time I enter something, it is already run up. So, which is why I like to stick to stocks that I think I have a very small stocks portfolio, but it is largely limited to stuff I think I understand. So, but most of the money is in, as of now, is in mutual funds and in fixed deposits. So
the next one is an interesting one. And you have titled it.
See, also let me give you an example. So there used to be this philosopher called Bertrand Russell. So Bertrand Russell had this very interesting chicken analogy. Okay, so let's say you are a farmer and you are essentially farming chickens. So you one of the you're probably the most important job that you would do is to feed the chicken at regular intervals at every day. Now think from the point of view of the chicken. Okay, now obviously no one's ever been able to ask the chicken what he's thinking about it. But think for a moment how the chicken looks at the world that he exists in. He knows that, you know, there is this guy who will probably come and keep feeding me at a given point of time, every day. Now in his head, he obviously assumes that this is something that is likely to continue. So essentially, you know, the human mind also works like that. We assume that our short-term circumstances will continue. And that is how things usually are, I mean, most of the time. But then one fine day, the farmer essentially cuts the chicken because he's ultimately, you know, that chicken is food on someone else's plate. That is how it is meant to be, right? So the chicken's assumption goes all wrong. So risk is, again, something that you do not see coming, okay? So similarly, I can give you an example from 2008 I remember it was a Monday and we were in office having our weekly meeting. And during the course of that meeting, the Sensex fell by 10%, okay? 10%, okay? On a given day. And then the index had to shut down for some time and all that happened. Now, obviously, when that morning started, nobody really knew that Sensex is going to fall by 10% today, right? So that risk nobody saw coming. So which is why, you know, as Mahendra Singh Dhoni keeps saying, it is important to control the controllables. You can only control what you can control. There's no point in trying to control what you cannot control. So controlling the controllables in this case means that you essentially, as I said, diversify. You know, you don't bet your life on one stock or one mutual fund or one asset class or whatever is the flavor of the season. Now, the point again is that, you know, there are people who, you know, who may go absolutely against this and do well, right? I mean, that can also happen. But all I'm trying to say is that since we cannot forecast, since we do not know what the future holds for us, so which is why we have to control the controllables. That is what it essentially means.
Controllable in the sense we can control our
emotion. we can control like, you know, we can control the fact that we will not invest all our money in Bitcoin. Okay, though even though it's been going up, you know, recently with that. But then, you know, so when, you know, in early 2021, I wrote some 3-4 pieces where I said that Bitcoin is a bubble and everything. And people like went after my life and they said, have fun staying poor. And and then it fell from some 67,000 to whatever, 20-25K. And a lot of people who had entered in the last part of the rally lost their shirts. And then the government cracked down, which is a bigger mess. Now, of course, if you had essentially, you know, spread your money across different investment avenues, then this would not have happened. Or, you know, it happens in a lot of small cap stocks. People essentially, so I, you know, I remember that when this Vodafone thing was happening, I met this investor who had bet his life on Vodafone stocks. I mean, you know, you don't do that. So that is why control the controllables, diversify money. And if you want to punt, have a very small part of your portfolio, which you can afford to lose. And a lot of us cannot afford to lose, right? So
I think one of his blog posts, I think Morgan Housel also said something interesting. I think he quoted some economist. I don't remember the exact name. But the quote is something goes something like this. Risk is what you... give me a second. Risk means more things can happen than will happen. And
yes, of course.
So I think he took the example of COVID, right? No one expected COVID.
Yeah, I mean, so COVID is a great example. So no one really expected COVID to happen, but it did happen. So.
And obviously people were tracking interest rate and, you know, all these other strategies, but yeah. Something which you don't see. Yeah. Lastly, the fifth point is the importance of cash.
I mean, so it's all again linked, you know. So we live in an era where money has been multiplying at a very fast rate, right? But so in this era, trying to tell people that you should have money in fixed deposits sounds quite stupid. But then, as you know, as I said, this is again controlling the controllables. If you know you cannot see the future, you obviously have to be in a position where some of your money is sort of stored away so that if you were to enter a scenario of financial emergency, you have money to get around it. So I'll give you a very, you know, simple example. At the beginning of COVID, a lot of people lost their jobs, right? And a lot of youngsters who were starting off did not have any savings. Okay, now, you know, it might just be because they were starting off or they might have been a year or two old in the profession that they were in and would have probably bought an Apple iPhone from their first salary and then gone on a holiday and stuff like that. Now, what that did was obviously that it put those people in a precarious position. Now, the second thing that happens is, you know, money in the bank essentially helps you negotiate better. Now, what do I mean by that? It essentially means, let's say you lose your job. And if you have savings, let's say a year's saving or maybe even more than that in your bank, in a fixed deposit or even in a normal savings bank account, you do not take on every trashy job that is offered to you. You are in a position to negotiate because you know that you have money to fall back upon. Or similarly, let's say you have home loan EMIs going on, right? A lot of people have, middle class people have home loan EMIs going on. And if you lose a job at, you know, somewhere, and it does happen these days, right? Job losses are pretty normal. So how do you continue paying the EMI? You know, you have to have some money stored away somewhere. So which is why it is important to sort of, again, as I said, it is important to be boring and have a part of your portfolio Obviously, in fixed deposit. Now, that obviously the proportion depends on your individual scenario in life. You know, whether you have your parents are dependent on you, whether your spouse is dependent on you, whether you have home loan EMIs, kids, what are the kind of expenses kids have. So, it is an individual thing, but life becomes simpler, though less exciting, if you have money stored away in a simple bank account.
This is actually very important. I know one person who bet 40 lakhs in this crypto company called Vault, and it was pitched as
40 lakhs.
Yeah.
Oh my God. There are so many. So such stories are pretty common. But then again, you know, now what is happening is if you know with crypto going back again, going up again, the volumes are also back. So people, you know, see, that's the thing. You know, retail investors enter an asset only after it has sort of gone up, and then the big guys come in and they sort of sell, make their money, and then these guys are sort of left behind. So I mean, it doesn't exactly play out like that all the time, but yeah, some of the times.
So I think, Vivek, we have completed the 5 points, but I'll give you one interesting thing to do. So I'll just give a revision of the point. You have to explain that point in one sentence, line.
Okay.
Just give it a try.
Okay.
For, you know, revision is always important,
sure,
right?
Sure,
before the exam.
Okay.
The Warren Buffett principle.
Regular investing, you know, whether you're doing an SIP or public provident fund or anything. So.
The do nothing principle.
Sit back and, you know, relax, watch cricket, watch movies, and do not get, you know, worried, inherently worried about your investment every day of the week.
How not to take cues from others.
Again, I mean, it's the same as do nothing here. So,
risk is what you don't see coming.
This is a tricky one. I mean, so basically, you know, the future is not forecastable, which is what it essentially means. I mean, tomorrow may not be like today. So, and you have to be prepared for that.
The importance of cash.
Again, tomorrow may not be like today, and you have to be prepared for that. So it's the same thing.
Got it. Yeah, I think we have completed, you know, our agenda. But as a bonus, you know, Vivek, you write such awesome articles. It's engaging, and, you know, you connect cricket with, you know, sport, investment with cricket and sport. In a way, how Morgan Housel does it. So would you like to give any, like, writing tips for us?
Okay. I mean, see, I might sound very boring when I say this. There are only two writing tips that I believe in. The first is reading, and the second is writing. The more you read, the better you will write. And the more you write, the better you will write. So that is all. Because so what happens is, when you read more, you obviously, you know, store away a lot of information in your subconscious. And essentially, I mean, I don't have very easy way to say this, but the more you read and the more things that keep getting stored in your subconscious, so then that subconscious essentially keeps throwing that memory back at you, and then that memory essentially makes it into what you write, and that helps you connect with people at large. So that is all that is there to it. I mean, everything else, grammar, wammer, etc., you know, which people make a lot of hangama about, can be learned, and now you have softwares which can, you know, essentially correct all that. So I think the most important part of writing is first reading and then writing. A lot of writers who, you know, ask, and I mean, this is not a pot shot at you, but a lot of writers who ask such questions essentially don't read enough, and they clearly don't write enough. So
that's true. Simple, sounds simple, but I'm sure it's...
No, it is very difficult, because, you know, you have to essentially every day, you know, be disciplined about the fact that you have to read a certain number of pages, or when, you know, when I write a book, I have to be disciplined about the fact that I will write 2,000 words every day, even though the next day I might get up and, you know, cut out most of it. But then that discipline is important. Even on days when the writing is not coming naturally to you, you have to sit and write those 2,000 words. So that is the process.
So, folks who are watching this video, we still have 5 more lessons. But yeah, that's topic for another day, I suppose.
Sure.
Thank you so much, Vivek, for coming.
Thanks for having me, Sachin.
That brings us to the end of today's episode. If you would like to know more about this topic, then you can reach out to me on Twitter. I go by the username @SachinNJ or LinkedIn using my full name, that is Sachin Ningthau Khongjam. We would be happy to take your suggestions. That's all from our side. Thanks for tuning in. See you in the next episode.
To stay updated on this podcast, follow us at HD Smartcast on all the major social media platforms. To listen to more such podcasts, log on to www.hdsmartcast.com.